The theory of transformation. This is getting down to serious business. And in a sense, really, the three elements of an emancipatory social theory that we've been exploring, the normative foundations, diagnosis and critique, and a theory of viable alternatives, all of those are really, when you get down to it, setting the stage for a theory of transformation. Because if we had a theory of viable alternatives, but no way whatsoever of thinking about how to get from here to there, it would serve a kind of spiritual function of some sort, but it wouldn't be part of an action plan. I think fundamentally, if you are embedding your work in some sort of emancipatory framework, what you really want your intellectual work to be directed towards is towards emancipation. That's what the adjective means. And for that to be true, you have to have some way of grappling with the question, what is to be done? This all, in a sense, plays off of Marx's famous 11th thesis of Feuerbach, probably one of the most quoted things from Marx, I suppose, of any single quote. Philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. Well, it's actually, that's a kind of nice little slogan. It's actually a pretty deep point when you think about it. The point is to change it. That implies that it's changeable. The point wouldn't be to change it if you couldn't change it. You know, if we changed it slightly, we said, astronomers have only interpreted the galaxies. The point, however, is to change it. What? You know, I mean, it would seem like a kind of stupid proposition. Physicists have only interpreted the basic causal forces of nature. The point is to change them. I would rather have a different law of gravity. Well, big deal. The point is, adding the point is to change it to that statement implies the world is changeable. Now, that's a really deep point. You know, and of course, it could be wrong. But it's the idea that we have as human beings the capacity to remake the world in a way we want, in ways that would emancipate human potentials. It's an incredibly ambitious idea. It could be wishful thinking. I mean, I don't believe that to be the case, but it's not something to be just taken for granted. It's not really something that should be just seen as axiomatic. We know we can change things in the small, in the way we want. You know, if you bake a cake and it comes out badly, you can diagnose the problem, you can imagine an alternative, you know. You have your normative foundations, you want a cake of a certain lightness and exuberance, and you can learn from your mistakes and make a better cake. So we know there's all sorts of things we can change by putting our human intentionality and purposes and intelligence to bear on it. It's just not so obvious that we can change the social world in the way that our longing impels us to. And that just remains an ambiguity. It should not be a paralyzing ambiguity. I think there's lots of evidence that there are possibilities. History isn't always kind. It isn't the case that at all moments in history we can remake the world as we wish. There do seem to be historical moments, windows of opportunity, when big changes are possible. And it may also be the case, and this is sort of where my own thinking has moved, that there are ways in which we can make practical changes in the world as it is, which prefigure a world as it might be, and which make that world more likely. So that's kind of an intermediate position between saying we can remake the world in one big, you know, kind of massive strategic move, and all we can do is little tinkering things in our immediate micro settings of life. The real utopia's idea is a kind of bridge between those two, that we can make practical changes in the world as it is that prefigure a world as it might be, as we would want, and which make that alternative world more likely rather than less likely. But all of this depends upon having a theory of transformation. One of the things that a theory of transformation means is that you have to have a theory of human agency. I use the word transformation rather than change. Social change, you know, social change is a kind of term that's used a lot in social theory. I prefer social transformation than social change. You know, this may be being a little precious with the use of words. I want to signal that human agency has to be behind this. Social change can be just the byproducts of what we do. Willy-nilly, the world changes by virtue of what we do. In our complex interactions, they get aggregated up, and the world 100 years later is different from what it was 100 years before. But without that change being the result of the purposes of people to bring about a particular kind of change. And somehow, the word transformation in English doesn't bring all that baggage with it that I am imputing to it, but it does have more of an agency-centered feel to it than just change. Anyway, I'm infusing it with that. Emancipatory transformation is unlikely simply as the byproduct of human action. It's just not very plausible that the kind of normatively informed transformations that we discussed earlier to realize those four values of equality, democracy, community, and sustainability, that those will happen just by accident, as the byproducts of everybody just doing their own thing, trying to make their own lives better, that somehow cumulatively that's going to produce this. That means that the kind of transformations that we want require conscious strategy. And if you want transformations that are the result of strategy, you need theories of the consequences of your actions. I mean, that's what strategy is. Strategy is making a set of choices about what to do now because of a belief that they will produce consequences in the future. That's what a strategy is. It's a future-oriented way of organizing your present practices. And in order to have any clue about what the consequences are, you need a good theory. This is sometimes referred to as the relationship between theory and practice. That little trope is you'll often encounter, what's the relationship between theory and practice? Well, that's basically, I think, what the guts of the relationship between theory and practice is. Theories tell you in advance what the likely consequences of your practices are, and theory helps you learn from what the actual consequences turn out to be. Theory helps you learn in ways that inform changes in your practices. There's a social psychologist, a famous social psychologist in the 30s and 40s named Kurt Lewin, L-E-W-I-N, although pronounced Levine, Kurt Levine. And he's famous for, I think his best line is, there is nothing so practical as a good theory. That should be the kind of watchword for Marxist theorizations. What we want is theory that's practical. There's nothing so practical as a good theory. Now that statement, I think, is at least in part directed at intellectuals as the producers of ideas and interpretations. I mean, that's what we do. Scholars, intellectuals, that's what we do. The statement of both Levine and of Marx, the philosophers have only interpreted the world, suggests that the kind of people we are, we shouldn't just be engaged in interpreting, but also in trying to change the world. I don't think that means that I don't think the prescription that comes from that idea, that our theories should be practical, they should help change the world, I don't think that means necessarily that it's a call for intellectuals to be on the barricades. You know, it's not a call necessarily for intellectuals to take leadership roles in social activism, although in some historical times and places that's appropriate. I think the main implication is that the production of ideas should be directed to the problem of what should be done. that's the kinds of ideas we want to produce are the ones which are most relevant in the most constructive way to that task. So this raises a kind of big question, which is, how do ideas and knowledge contribute to changing the world in the way we want? What actually is the potential role for ideas? How should we think about that problem? We're going to spend some focused time on that question when we explore the problem of ideology. So that block of the course on ideology, which will come in November, that block of the course really concerns this question of the role of ideas and how we should think about them acting in the world. But here, let me make three principal points, just to kind of set the stage. First, as I've already said, having a strategy means having a theory of consequences of actions. Being able to anticipate what will happen if we do X, what the consequences will be. So you're not just acting out of despair and anger as an expression of your state of being. Rather, your actions are oriented towards your anticipation of what the world will be like given that you've acted that way. That means a theory of consequences. And that's a scientific question. And I mean, you know, I use the word scientific, that some sense shudders up some people's spines if they're critical theorists, because science also has this authoritarian expert know-it-all kind of aura about it. I think that's a mistake. I think science is the right word to use for claims about the consequences of action, which are always subject to debate and interrogation and disputation, as opposed to certainty. So it's a way of arguing against the authoritative pronouncements of leaders who say, do this because it will have these consequences. The challenge is, why do you believe it'll have these consequences? What are the mechanisms? What's the evidence? That's what a scientific interrogation demands. So that's why I use the term science. For those of you who are not so embedded in a kind of left culture, it may seem weird to even be worrying about the use of the word science in this way. You know, so when I belabor this point, it's because of a long history of debates with various people with whom I share complete community in terms of values and purposes, but in which they claim that my insistence on science is epistemologically suspect. And so I'm very insistent on at least arguing why this is the right way of thinking about the kind of knowledge we want. That's the first point. A second point is, we need a capacity to learn from our mistakes. And that means to learn the right lessons from mistakes. The chronic problem in political practices and political action is learning the wrong lessons. It's, of course, defeats are going to happen. It's inevitable in the kinds of struggles and the kind of transformations that we're talking about that you lose. We always want it to be a simple world. No, you lose more often than you win. The problem is, what lessons do you learn from your mistakes? And it's awfully easy to learn the wrong lessons. And only if you have a critical scientific perspective on things in which you really care about the adequacy of the knowledge you're producing can you learn the right lessons. I want to tell you what for me as a professor over the last 35 years was one of the most moving moments of my career that happened in this class about 20, God, it must be close to 30 years ago. Time flies when you're having fun, right? In the mid-1980s. So I had a particular class that was, some years this class is really filled with activists who are really in the trenches, you know, who are very committed and involved in various kinds of political groups. And this was in the 1980s during the Reagan administration. And there was a circle of students who were really very deeply engaged in their own lives in terms of the amount of time they were spending and energy they were devoting to various kinds of activist work, and in the course of the semester got increasingly impatient with the level of abstraction that I was presenting and the extent to which we would be worrying about precise definitions and these kinds of abstract issues. And there was basically an insurrection in the class. You know, they formed a caucus and they said, we've got to stop class. We have to have a kind of criticism session where we just evaluate where we're going, and we want more sessions that are devoted to practical things, what they consider practical things. You know, what should be done now? And it turned out in that class, there was an exile from the island of Grenada in the Caribbean who had been the deputy minister of education when the United States invaded. And he was in exile and was a graduate student, a Michael Apple student in the education program here. Very compelling, you know, warm, interesting person. And we were having this very tumultuous discussion, and I was happy to have the discussion in the class and you know, let the students in the class argue about it. And then he stood up, and I thought, oh, God, I'm really going to get slammed. I mean, he had such moral credibility because, you know, he was with the left government and was one of the people who was exiled from his country because of the opposition of the United States. And through various means, he managed to end up being able to be here. And I thought he was going to be the person who was going to really insist on, got to be more revolutionary on the ground in a practical way. And he stood up and said that if only the leadership of the Grenadian Revolution had taken this class and had learned to think clearly and had learned to distinguish between a pat revolutionary slogan and a serious analysis, they would have been in way better shape to contend with the pressures and contradictions that they were facing. He became my biggest defender in the class. I practically cried when he... I mean, it was partially relief, but it was just incredibly moving to me, the sense in which he affirmed this crucial idea that having clear ideas and understanding what you don't understand, rather than papering over it, so that you can respond to the contradictions and not just stubbornly stick to the pure position, the extreme uncompromising position on the grounds that any compromise represents a moral taint, as opposed to compromises are the way you recognize that the consequences in the world depend upon the balance of forces, not just the strength of your will. The opposite of a scientific understanding is a kind of pure voluntarism, where you believe that by the strength of your heroic will you can accomplish anything. But of course that's not true. And it's important to recognize that. Well, that I bring up that story as an affirmation of this idea that ideas matter because learning from mistakes and having the clarity to distinguish between the moral slogans that inspire us to action and the analysis of the situation that actually tells us what we need to do as best we can, being able to distinguish those two. And distinguishing between those two is hard. And that's why you need a theory of transformation. All of these tasks are made more difficult, this is a point I made earlier, because of this dual role of Marxist theory as a revolutionary ideology as well as a scientific framework. It does double duty. And it therefore simultaneously embodies in a fantastically powerful and effective way what I have also, I think, used this expression called charismatic wishful thinking. That's what an inspiring ideology does. It captures your deepest longings and hopes in a charismatic way, that is, in an emotionally charged and uplifting way, charismatic wishful thinking. Marxism embodies that, which it should as an ideology. That's what ideologies do when they're good, when they're effective, when they're coherent. They do inspire. Combines that with using the same words, class, state, ideology, contradiction, capitalism, uses the same words to develop a theory of the obstacles to social transformation and how we can learn from experience. And it's difficult to have a single language that's doing that double duty. And sometimes that's created huge tensions, sometimes bloody tensions. You know, there have been brutal clashes with lives lost over such issues. Well, all of that tells us something about why we need a theory of transformation. Then the question is, what kind of a theory do we need? You know, what's going to be the substance of it? Here I just want to make a brief point that I've also, I think, made at least in passing in one of the earlier lectures. And that's the distinction between a really ambitious, comprehensive social theory that attempts to tie everything together, what sometimes is called grand theory, or in a slightly different context, grand narratives, very ambitious efforts to develop comprehensive theories of society and history. That's one way of thinking about what we want. We want a theory of transformation that's embedded in a grand paradigm that's comprehensive. And there was a time when I, in my own work, characterized Marxism in that way. And I saw it, I treated my work as contributing to a reconstruction of a comprehensive social scientific paradigm. There's an earlier piece I wrote on these themes where I distinguished between two ways of engaging Marxism. One was as a paradigm in which you engaged it to reconstruct it to make it a more comprehensive and effective paradigm. And the other was to engage it eclectically, where you drew the particular ideas that seemed relevant to any particular problem, but you didn't have any comprehensive commitment to it as a paradigm. I've now pulled back from that way of thinking about the problem. I think of the Marxist tradition and the kind of theory of transformation we want as having more the character of a theoretical framework rather than a paradigm, rather than an all-encompassing explanatory structure, but rather as a framework that establishes a broad set of concepts that are organized around a logically constructed agenda. So it's a framework of analysis that helps us develop our theories of particular problems. But it's non-exclusionary. There's no prohibitions against drawing from all sorts of other frameworks as needed to deal with particular problems. And there's no pretense that it's seamless, that it has all the pieces in place. I think of this as a kind of pragmatist compromise between the ambitions of totalizing paradigms on the one hand and the fragmentation that comes from a purely empiricist research practice where you don't care at all about frameworks. You just pick and choose little bits and pieces and stick them together. So I try to navigate a kind of pragmatic grounds between those two extremes. Now, this is a particular set of issues that will be most relevant to some of the graduate students here who think about these big theory issues, especially if you're taking advanced sociological theory courses. If you're new to this kind of discussion, some of these issues just may seem too distant from any practical or substantive concerns to worry about. Eventually, I think, as if you stay reading in these kinds of works, you'll see why worrying about these issues. How comprehensive is the theory? When we get to the unfortunately too short section on class and gender, for example, I will argue against hyphenated Marxism-feminism, which suggests that there's some totality within which these two bodies of ideas can be fully integrated. Rather, Marxism plus feminism. That is, these are different theoretical frameworks identifying different clusters of mechanisms, and we need them both, but that they can't be subsumed under some master framework, at least not given the existing frameworks of knowledge we have, and I suspect probably in principle. We'll be discussing that in a few weeks. Okay, so what kind of theoretical framework do we need? I think we need not so much comprehensive paradigms. I think it's probably not a bad thing that some people work on these ideas as if they were comprehensive paradigms. That's one way of doing theory, and it's probably a good thing in our intellectual ecology that there's some people who are stubbornly still building comprehensive paradigms. But I think the kind of softer, less ambitious view of wanting frameworks that have good concepts and clear agendas, that's really the kind of theory of transformation we need. Well, with that as the background, then what is the framework that I'm proposing that we think about a theory of transformation? As I lay it out in that chapter, which is, a very condensed programmatic chapter. You know, I pack a lot into that chapter on a theory of transformation. As I laid it out there, there are four central things that have to be sorted out. So this is the agenda part. So as an agenda part, as an agenda for the framework, this would apply for a feminist theory of transformation as well as a class theory of transformation. Or rather, one should say a theory of class transformation as much as a theory of gender transformation. So feminism contains a theory of gender transformation. Marxism contains a theory of class transformation. That's the stuff of what Marxism is all about, a theory of the transformation of class relations. Any theory of transformation, I think, of the sort that we need, the agenda would have four components. A theory of social reproduction. This is the A, B, C, and D under Roman numeral 3. A theory of social reproduction. This is an account of the obstacles to emancipatory transformation. A theory of the gaps and contradictions of reproduction. That is an explanation for how, in spite of these obstacles, there are real possibilities of transformation. Third, a theory of the underlying dynamics and trajectory of unintended social change, which would tell us about the future prospects of both obstacles and possibilities. So the third element is essentially a projection into the future of the first two. Right, so the first one is a theory of reproduction. The second one is a theory of the contradictions within the process of reproduction. Reproduction and its contradictions. The third is a theory about the future state of the world with respect to those first two elements. But the future state of the world that's the result of the unintended result of our actions. And the fourth element is a theory of transformative strategies. What is to be done? And it's basically, in light of these first three elements, all right, what should we do? What are the strategies to engage in the production of transformation, given what we know about the obstacles, given what we know about their contradictions, and given what we know about the likely future states of the obstacles and contradictions? Given all of that, it's a hell of a lot to say given. Given all of that, what should we do now? If you had a clear and well-established theory of each of, theoretical arguments and answers for each of those elements, you'd have a very powerful theory of transformation. Okay, let me then explicate a little bit more each of these elements. And I think we can do that pretty well by our prescribed 11 o'clock break, and then we'll have a freewheeling discussion. Okay, first, social reproduction. Yeah, at first thought, when you first think about these things, it might seem a little strange to begin a theory of transformation, to say the starting point is a theory of social reproduction. All right, that might seem a little odd. We're concerned about transformation. Why do we begin with an account of reproduction? I think we begin with the account of reproduction because of what I call, I'm going to skip down to number three first, and then I'll go back. I think the reason to begin with a theory of reproduction is because of the what I call the fundamental proposition of social reproduction. This is the kind of the foundational proposition of social reproduction. The foundational proposition of social reproduction is social structures and institutions that systematically impose harms on people require vigorous mechanisms of active social reproduction in order to be sustained over time. If the social world is creating harms in the lives of people, if you're in that kind of world where the institutions and structures in which people live are damaging to them, those institutions and structures continue over time, not out of inertia, not simply because they exist. So they don't just sort of automatically, passively reproduce themselves just out of inertia. They require active mechanisms to maintain them in place. That I consider a fundamental, very abstract, general proposition that applies to patriarchy, it applies to class, it applies to racism, it applies to any structure of institutional arrangements that causes harms in the lives of people. That's a pretty strong statement. It implies a fairly universalistic view of harms. It's not a relativist statement. It says about Saudi Arabia today that the harms which my analysis would diagnose the harms in the lives of women, that those harms are maintained because there are active mechanisms that coercively, among other mechanisms, maintain them. Not because it's just a different culture and women as well as men believe that a life of extremely restricted possibility for women is just the way things should be. It's not because of some deep moral consensus, which then just self-perpetuates, just continues, because once people believe that, then the system just reproduces itself automatically. It requires disciplining. It requires active reproduction. So that's my claim, that systems that produce harms require active mechanisms to maintain them. If that weren't true, if it were the case that you could have systems that produce real harms in the lives of people, and once in place, the cultural forms that people come to believe in simply by virtue of living in such a system, that is not by virtue of propaganda and socialization and priests constantly reiterating these ideas in a purposeful way, but just because of the mundane ways in which your beliefs are formed through your daily practices, that this would just perpetuate this indefinitely. That would be a rejection of this fundamental thesis. And then you wouldn't need any specialized machinery to reproduce the social order. It would just continue on its own. That fundamental proposition really depends upon, I think, three sorts of claims. And again, these are strong claims, which not everybody agrees with. The first is a claim about the human condition, that these harms are real. The damage to the lives of people caused by these oppressive forms of social relations are real. They can be diagnosed. It's a claim about human nature. There's a claim about some universal principles of human motivations and capacities that we can apply to all people, regardless of where they live, that children dying of malnutrition is universally seen as a harm, not just in some societies where people feel this is fine and other societies where they feel this is not. So the pretty broad universalism to what is experienced as damaging because of our nature. And an implication that if we observe that there's no challenges to oppression, we observe malnourished children, lives that are deeply harmed, and we observe no challenges, that requires an explanation. That is, if you believe that it's unsurprising that people don't resist when they're harmed, then you wouldn't expect, then you don't demand of those situations some special explanation. I always find my thesis, the implication of this fundamental proposition of social reproduction is that the absence of challenges to oppression requires an explanation. It's not the spontaneous, ordinary consequence of being human that when we are harmed, we don't do anything. And I make that as a universal claim. That when harms are imposed on people, you expect them to resist. If they don't resist, that requires some special explanation. That is, we need to understand the mechanisms which block the resistance. Let me backtrack. First, this contrast between passive and active reproduction. So, a lot of social theory that talks about, that uses the expression social reproduction, that term, social reproduction, often it is identified with what I refer to as passive reproduction. Bourdieu's notion of habitus, for example, is pretty much what I'm calling passive reproduction, passive social reproduction. The key idea is that in all of the ways in which we go about living our lives in a mundane manner, just in our ordinary interactions with other people, this contributes to reproducing the social relations within which we live. That people learn the kinds of skills and orientations through daily practice that is needed in order for them to make their way in the world comfortably and easily. They learn the rules of the game, and as they learn the rules of the game, they're able to play the game effectively. That's essentially Bourdieu's habitus. These become internalized in our spontaneous, unthoughtful, that is, without reflection, ways of doing things. It's very close to conventional sociological ideas of socialization. It's another way of talking about this. All of this contributes to passive social reproduction. Active social reproduction refers to the ways in which institutions are purposefully designed to reproduce social relations. What Marxists call the superstructure. That's a kind of old-fashioned term. But the superstructures are all forms of active reproduction. Courts, police, ideological apparatuses of propaganda, of deliberate socialization. So the socialization that occurs in a family when a mother and a father correct the behavior of a child is different from the socialization that occurs in the school, where there's a set curriculum designed to inculcate particular orientations of action. So the deliberate designing of those institutions to block certain kinds of behaviors, to encourage others, to model certain kinds of conformity or not. All of these kinds of purposeful institutions of reproduction, that's what I'm referring to as active reproduction. The boundary between active and passive reproduction is not a bright one. It's not a sharp one, because the routinization of systems of active reproduction begins to function pretty automatically. Without a whole lot of reflexivity, except in moments when it's challenged. So there's a lot more to say about that distinction, but I think as a broad stroke distinction between two ways in which systems get reproduced, they get reproduced through the just ordinary performance of social practices in daily interaction, and they get reproduced by specific mechanisms designed to keep things in place. One other general initial comment, and this has to do with the issue of functionalism. We will have one or two sessions at various points throughout the semester where we discuss this idea of functionalism more systematically. This is a key theme in many theories, discussions of social reproduction, which has to do with the connection between active social active reproduction and passive reproduction. And it's the question of whether and the ways in which institutions are designed in such a way as to socialize people in particular ways so that their daily actions reproduce the society. This gets very close to a functionalist explanation in which you diagnose every institution as serving the function of stabilizing the society. The question that we will be addressing is whether a functional kind of explanation, don't worry about this now, just store it in the back of your mind, because it's a theme we will be addressing. It'll be clear when we do. Whether a functional explanation is the best way of thinking about these. Are social systems the kind of entities in which all of the parts serve functions for the whole? Is that the way we should think about how everything fits together? That this is a functional system. And in what ways yes, and in what ways no? I will argue for a somewhat paradoxical idea, what I will call contradictory functionality later, rather than pure functionalism, contradictory functionality. Okay, point four. This is, again, this is just making a side point in a way that will be relevant to highfalutin sociologists interested in grand social theory. The ideas about social reproduction which I'm laying forth here fit into sort of grand social theory in a way that I think is clarified by making the following contrast. Think of it this way. What is the problem for which social reproduction is a solution? If mechanisms of social reproduction are the answer, what is the question? And I want to draw a contrast then between two ways of thinking about that issue. The first is what in classical sociology is called the problem of order. The problem of order. The problem of order was first given systematic articulation by Thomas Hobbes in his famous book, The Leviathan. And what Hobbes argues is that in the absence of a strong state, we will live in a world of war of all against all. And life will be nasty, brutish, and short. There's some sort of little phrase that Thomas Hobbes used. That is, in the absence of social reproduction, what you get is chaos. You get the law of the jungle, the war of all against all, dog eat dog, the survival of the fittest. The absence of social reproduction is disorder, chaos. In the Marxian framework, the absence of social reproduction is revolution. Or to say it more broadly, social transformation. That is, what social reproduction blocks is emancipatory transformation, rather than what social reproduction blocks is the war of all against all. Now, this is a crucial contrast, and it, in some ways, is a contrast that divides more conservative from more left-wing social theory. Conservatives are worried about chaos. And the purpose of social order is to create order. The purpose of social reproduction is to create order so that we can live our lives in a reasonably safe and secure way. And in the absence of all of these mechanisms that constrain and curtail our actions, in the absence of those mechanisms, we'd all be fighting with each other all the time. Chaos is the threat, the counterfactual to social reproduction. Whereas in the Marxian tradition and other more progressive traditions of social theory, in the absence of these powerful mechanisms of state and ideology and religion and all the other ways in which social reproduction occurs, in the absence of them, what would happen? We'd have social emancipation. Now, the thing I think to really worry about here is I think both theories are right. I think chaos is a problem. There is something worse than living in a capitalist, a well-ordered and disciplined capitalist society. Civil wars and chaos and warlordism and predatory behavior between groups of well-armed people, that's a worse world to live in. So chaos and disorder is a possible outcome of failures of social reproduction, but also social transformation is. And it is. This is captured in the classical Marxian quip about the future of capitalism being either socialism or barbarism. Now that quip, when capitalism breaks down, that is when its system of social reproduction collapses, what does the future hold? Well, one classical Marxian argument is what the future holds is socialism or barbarism. And that captures these two points. The barbarism alternative is the conservative sphere. The socialism alternative is the leftist hope. And I think both views are correct under different historical and contingent possibilities. That is, the conservative fear should not be dismissed out of hand, because I think the evidence from history suggests that the dissolution of systems of social reproduction can unleash chaotic forces which need not be a pathway towards a reconstruction around a more emancipatory alternative. They may be, they may not be. And therefore, the conservative worry about the dissolution of systems of social reproduction is a legitimate worry and a challenge then to our own social and scientific theory. All right, all of that sort of sets the stage. Then the question is, what's the substance of a theory of social reproduction? We're going to, the part of the course that's on the state and ideology is going to be above all about mechanisms of social reproduction. That's the way we will discuss the state and ideology. Here I'm just going to list without extended comment, just so we can stick to the time, the four types of mechanisms. If you want to build up a theory of social reproduction, these are the kinds of things you have to weave together in your theory. First and most simply is coercion. One way that social relations are reproduced is by the threat of force. So if you violate the established rules, one of the consequences is you might get beaten up, arrested, shot. This applies to whether the rules be the rules of gender within families, let's say, or the rules of compliance within workplaces or whatever. Whatever the social practices that are being governed by mechanisms of reproduction, one of the mechanisms that keep those relations in place, that block their transformation, is coercion. A second mechanism is what I would call institutional rules, the routinized procedures and norms that tell people what they're supposed to do in what circumstances. The third is ideology, which in this context refers to the subjective orientations of actors and their understandings and beliefs about how the world works, which includes their beliefs about institutional rules and coercion. And finally, there are interests. Actually, how does the system serve your interests or not? That's one of the ways that systems of social relations get reproduced, is by the interests of those who are least advantaged or disadvantaged or most disadvantaged or oppressed, depending upon the language you want to use, the ways in which their interests are at least in limited ways satisfied by the existing systems of domination. Sorry about that. Should have turned it off to begin with. And we'll be discussing how, in fact, one of the reasons why capitalism is so stable is the way it actually is able to organize interests of subordinated and exploited groups in ways in which they are at least partially satisfied rather than completely marginalized. These four mechanisms get consolidated into broadly, this is again a big oversimplification, but we can think of two broad configurations of social reproduction. Despotic configurations in which coercion and rules are central, and ideology and interests serve to reinforce those forms of coercion and rules. And hegemonic configurations in which ideology and interests are central and coercion and rules support the effectiveness of ideology. The distinction between a hegemonic and a despotic order, the distinction between a hegemonic and a despotic social order, I would describe this as hegemonic and despotic systems of social reproduction, is that in a hegemonic system, the interests of people and their beliefs are what really drive the stability of the structure, and what coercion and rules do is prevent drift. Whereas in a despotic system, it's coercion and rules which really explain why the world continues to be stable, what reproduces these relations. And interests and ideology simply serve to shore up the mechanisms of coercion. So in a despotic order, it's important that the interests of the guards be protected. So the interests of the enforcers, of the coercers, need to be incorporated within the regime. And they have to have an ideology that makes them loyal repressors, that makes them feel connected to ruling elites. So ideology and interest still play a role in a despotic regime, but it plays a role in stabilizing the mechanisms of coercion, of despotism. Whereas in a hegemonic regime, the real core of the stability of the regime is the consent of the people, bound up with the way their interests are served by the regime. Capitalism is, in the developed world, has been broadly hegemonic because the interests of workers have been accommodated, albeit in a subordinated way, and backed by ideology which leads them to believe that this system is a desirable one, with coercion and rules keeping those elements in play. We will, in the state and ideology section, that's the stuff of what we'll be talking about. That's the guts of the problem. Okay, just a few minutes. Well, we've got through the first element of a theory of transformation. What I wrote in, I don't have a, my views on these matters are not that different, haven't evolved that much from the chapter in Envisioning Real Utopias. That book, I hope, is not my final swan song view on these matters, but it was only published a few years ago, and I put an awful lot of work into it. So in the spirit of wanting our discussion time not to get constantly encroached by my enthusiasm for explaining these things verbally, I'm not going to try to get through all the rest of it. We can elaborate these other points as we go. Let me, on the gaps and contradictions of reproduction, let me just make a couple of points about that idea. If you have a strong theory of reproduction about how ideology, consent, coercion, institutional rules and interests, how all these constitute a system which reproduces social relations, if that's all you have is a theory of social reproduction, and you don't have a theory of the gaps, inconsistencies, and contradictions within that, then you have a totalizing theory of domination. You have the kind of theory which leads people to believe you're in an iron cage where there's nothing you can really do because the mechanisms of subordination are so powerful that every act of resistance simply contributes to reproducing the system. The strongest forms of these go say things of the form that every act of resistance just affirms to people that the system, isn't this great? The system allows people to resist, and that makes it even stronger. It's a really you're damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of world. If you don't resist, then the system is stronger because there's no resistance. If you do resist, the system is stronger because it shows that it can tolerate resistance. Marcuse's notion of repressive tolerance in one-dimensional man has a bit of that character, where when people use the free press to denounce the system, this only strengthens the system even more. Why? Because it shows that the system tolerates opposition, and therefore it's so robust it's not fragile. That kind of totalizing view is rarely explicitly defended, but it's often pretty close to the surface in social theory. Some of Foucault, and certainly Foucauldians, if not Foucault, at least people who use Foucault, domination penetrates the pores of society so pervasively and without internal contradiction that resistance becomes pointless. Resistance doesn't have a capacity to create fractures, to create spaces of autonomy. It just strengthens domination, or itself reflects and embodies new forms of domination. I think a theory of transformation needs to resist that kind of totalizing theory. But I also think, and this is a hard point, you know, it's a hard point to kind of explain and to really get home, it should not be axiomatic that there are the contradictions and gaps. You have to discover them, and you have to provide evidence and argument for them. We could live in a totalizing world again. It could be pointless to struggle against it, because all struggles against it will just be expressions of our discontent, but not have transformative effects, because there are no possibilities, because there are no contradictions of the sort that would allow those transformative practices any purchase for change. Okay, again, I'm stating the most bleak and dismal possibility, not because I believe it. And on the podcast, you hear that, I don't believe it. I don't want to be quoted out of context here. Not because I believe it, but because I believe we shouldn't take it for granted. We should not take it for granted that the nature of the tensions within a system of social reproduction create openings in which we can engage in transformative practice. That's why this is a theoretical problem. It's an agenda item. It has to be studied and explored. The gaps and contradictions of reproduction. And I list four kind of focuses, four ways in which gaps and contradictions play themselves out within a system of reproduction. That's the second of the four items. The third is the underlying dynamics and trajectory of unintended change. This is a super big topic. The history of the future will be the result of two kinds of processes which propel the world from as it is to as it will be. One is the unintended byproducts of the actions of people. We all do stuff. Some of us are powerful and do big things. Most of us are not, and we do small things. But the cumulative effect of all the things people do now in the world, all of the actions and practices and strategies of what people do now, the cumulative effect of that as the byproduct, not as the purpose of why we do what we do, but as a byproduct of what we do, will be a world that will be different 10 years from now, 100 years from now. So big corporations will invest in various parts of the world, and as a result, they will destroy traditional ways of life, and people will move to cities, and the world will be different in those places. But the big, powerful corporations that did that did not invest in those places in the world in order to destroy traditional ways of life, in order to get people to move to the city, to create new concentrations of slums and insurgency. They did it in order to make money. So it's an unintended byproduct, that trajectory of change, of people, powerful people, not powerful people, simply engaging in practices often of adaptation and survival. When women left the home to seek employment in the late 50s and 60s and accelerating in the 70s, because of increased employment opportunities and stagnations of family wages, they did not do so in order to transform at the macro-cultural level gender relations. They did so in order to improve their own conditions of life and the lives of their families and their own, you know, spaces of social interaction. But the cumulative consequence of the transformation of women's role in the labor market was to really transform the conditions of struggle over gender relations. That's the unintended consequences. But the future will also be brought about by the intended efforts of people, the intended effects of conscious projects of social change. And understanding the interplay of those two is the real stuff of what a theory of the history of the future is all about. And that's the part of the whole, this whole agenda, which is the weakest, where we have the least firm grounds. It's also, ironically, the part of this whole structure where Marx and the classical sort of Marxist tradition felt that it made the deepest contribution. Classical Marxism, the theory of history, is precisely an attempt at systematically connecting the cumulative unintended byproducts of the actions of people with the cumulative intended effects of conscious projects of social change. That's the guts of historical materialism. That was the hugely ambitious effort that Marx had to produce a theory of the history of the future, or what's called historical materialism. We will, at the very last part of the course, we will look at how Marx attempted to do that, what the classical Marxian theory of history looked like. I think it is one of the most extraordinarily ambitious theories of any sort, not just in social science, any kind of theory ever proposed. It's brilliant in its structure as a kind of intellectual product. It's just not, I think, compelling as a scientific account. And it hasn't been replaced by a better one. That is, I do not think we have the kind of theory of the cumulative effect of unintended byproducts of the actions of people into the future that would help us to really develop a strategy for transformation. So we basically have to develop, we still need a strategy of transformation, but it's forced to contend with a gap in the full agenda, where we do have a lot to say about reproduction, huge theoretical armory about what are the mechanisms that reproduce the social order, and a lot of very good elements of a theory of contradiction, of gaps, of inconsistencies, of dysfunction, of failure in the way social systems. So the first two components, we've got lots and lots of stuff that's firm and interesting, but only a weak version of the third element, and yet we have to do strategies, the fourth, which is ultimately, of course, where the action is, what is to be done. And that's the theoretical space in which we operate. Okay, only 7 minutes past the hour. That's not too bad. Let's reconvene at 11:15. Does that work for everybody? Okay, 11:15. Come prepared with